Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is December 1st, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we do in every podcast, I have on me here my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Christian?
Good to be here, Neil.
Let me just say up front, as always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team here at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it. You can find out about it. Among other things, you'll be able to get our newswire. You can watch my show on COVID-19. Got, I think, increasing number of special interviews with guests. And I should add that I'm now offering a special discount for a limited time only through the holidays, which I guess that is limited time. It's just a little bit coming up. I will put the link in today's show summary, and I've also pinned the link to my Twitter page. This week we have, guess what? Another conversation. That's right. This time with Andrew Friedman, who is the head of Hedgeye's communications sector. He is, I must say, a millennial dynamo, delivering accurate calls on everything from Facebook and Google to Disney and Netflix. But he also covers a lot of smaller companies. And in this interview, which we taped last week, we'll be covering some of those. Our topics are the online dating industry, and my gosh, there's all kinds of social and demographic drivers behind the success of the Match Group and some of the other players in that industry. We're going to talk about interactive media. What's up with VR, AR, and metaverse platforms like Roblox? And any of you who's been at home over the Thanksgiving with little kids, likely they are playing Roblox, and they're probably getting, as gifts, little Roblox credits. I think that's going to show up in a lot of stockings, little Roblox credit cards. And finally, we're going to talk about the new salience of social media regulation in the wake of the Justice Antitrust case recently filed against Google, and growing Republican support for regulating social media on all fronts. I think I'm going to love this conversation, but before we get to the replay, let's cover some of the news, and we can start with our usual start, and that is with you, Christian, and how the markets did this past week.
All right, Neil. Well, since our last podcast, which was 9 trading days ago, the S&P 500 actually hasn't had much movement. It was up 0.3%. The markets haven't closed today, but it is looking, right now, the markets are doing well. The global Dow has done a little better, up 2.8%, and the VIX closed yesterday at 20.57, so it keeps inching a little bit more down.
Yeah, it's going up big time today. This comes after, I think, the prior week. It certainly went up before, right? So,
right.
And we see what's volatility today. You probably just mentioned it, and I just let it go right past me. It's
20.57.
We'll get back and talk a little bit about the market in a second, but why don't you cover some of the economic indicators?
Yeah, so we got for the ISM manufacturing PMI came in from November. It came in at 57.5, so that's the 7th straight month of expansion. We also got the market manufacturing PMI. That rose to 56.7 for November, again showing a rise. Market service PMI for November came in at 57.7. That was up from expectations of 55. The other big indicator was the Chicago Fed National Activity Index. Now, this comes out for October. You know, it's usually a, a behind index, but it takes 85 different indicators. You know, the average reading is zero, and it came in at 0.83 for October, and that was way above the expectation of 0.1. So that was some good news. Then international, we got numbers from China. The Caixin manufacturing PMI was above expectations at 54.9 for November. Now, this manufacturing PMI does private business. And then the NBS manufacturing PMI for November came in at 52.1, which was also a rise. And this looks more at state-owned companies.
Got it. And what about Europe?
Europe, services are way down at 41. But manufacturing is actually looking a little bit better. It's in the 53 range.
Yes, I think. Well, it's interesting. I mean, we certainly there's a lot behind today's rally. I think it's pretty likely we're going to see, you know, well above 1% up and the VIX down again. There's a lot pushing the good news. Certainly the recent reports, the ongoing news of the vaccine high success rates. We had Pfizer and Moderna, then we have AstraZeneca as well. This is a slightly different, it's not a mRNA vaccine, it's a virus vector vaccine. It works through an adenovirus, but it looks like it's pretty good. They have to go back and fix some of their statistics. Moderna has just joined Pfizer in applying for emergency use authorization from the FDA and may actually be, if all goes well, delivering some of its first doses by the end of December, although clearly significant numbers of vaccinations. I think people, again, I've said this before, I think we're really looking at Q2 and Q3. We also have a stimulus package. That was a big news today, and I think that was actually part of the big move today. What's that about?
Right, well, this is a $900 billion proposal, Neil. It includes unemployment insurance for $300 a week for 18 weeks. $160 billion would go to state and local governments, and $288 billion would go towards the Paycheck Protection Program. Now, this was introduced by a bipartisan group of senators. When I say bipartisan, I'm sure you can guess who spearheaded it. Susan Collins, Joe Manchin. They really need to get this passed soon because, as Mark Warner from Virginia said, this is an interim bill to get them through to when Joe Biden becomes president. But Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell have been silent on whether they will support this bill.
Well, if they get... Susan Collins, who's now the most powerful person in the Senate, or likely to be after, January 6th, when all the new people get in there. It's really interesting. I mean, obviously, they all need to get on board. And then most importantly, Trump has to sign it. I think it goes without saying that they can't, they'll never be able to overcome a veto. We'll see what he does. Yeah, that's interesting. Otherwise, what? We have to wait for, February, right?
Yeah.
For some emergency Biden initiative to come in. But certainly that stimulated the market. I thought that was good news. You begin to see some real market signs of bullishness. I know that the 10-year yield is finally going up today. We're above 0.9 again. That's good. The volatility is way down. I believe the VIX is down from something like 37 back at the beginning of the month, down to 20.8. I think yesterday probably is going to be down a little bit more today. But more importantly, and this is something I often look at, is that the short-term implied volatility versus long-term, that whole curve is bending down. And so most of the time, in a calm time, long-term volatility is lower than short-term vol. But of course, during market turbulence and everyone demands short-term options, particularly puts, that drives up the short-term cost. So this is a very interesting indicator of moving from a bearish mood to a bullish mood in the markets. That if you look back on November 2nd, the ratio of the three-month ahead volatility, that's sort of the three-month future VIX versus just the current VIX, fell from 1.06 to 0.84, right? And the six-month future vol, future VIX to the one-month, fell from 1.11 to 0.79. So you can see there's been this radical shift in the forward curve in volatility. That, along with the VVIX, the volatility of volatility, is something that the macro guys at HedgeEye can they can talk on and on about that. And I know Keith often does. The other news, which is, of course, the potentially bad news, is infections and deaths, which is interesting. It's short-term down. But of course, no one knows how much this is just the impact of Thanksgiving and the holidays keeping down reporting. Right now, it's been down. I mean, we're now into what? We've just, seen reporting from Monday night. I think everyone is, why don't I just say we're all holding our breaths, both literally and figuratively, for the numbers which are going to be released for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, right? Are we going to see a Thanksgiving rebound and a continuation of the, big second or third wave that we've been fearing about, right? That we've been dreading, I should say, and that's obviously keeping the markets realistic in the short term. Well, meanwhile, Trump has announced he will leave the White House. He was asked in a recent press conference, will he leave the White House? And he said, and I'll quote him here, certainly I will. You know that. Well, I guess some people didn't know that. So anyway, I guess we all know that now. But here's an interesting story, Christian. He is investigating whether to announce a new run for the presidency in 2024 and do that announcement during the Biden inauguration. Isn't that just what you'd expect? I mean, I think that's just wonderful. And it's just Trump being Trump, right? And he said, apparently, no one wants to watch that boring guy. I think the TV stations would all prefer to. And he may be right about that, actually. Anyway, I think this is terrible news for, I think this is much worse news for the Republicans, frankly, than it is for the Democrats. I mean, I think the last thing the Republican Party wants to see is Trump rallying a galvanized core, because that is going to be a big problem for the rest of the Republican Party moving forward. This promises to repeat the kind of the bull moose schism in the Republican Party, which, happened about a century ago, right? And that allowed Woodrow Wilson to be elected, the first Democrat in many, many terms to get in there. So I don't know. We will have occasion to talk about in the future, certainly, about what is going to happen politically. We have two radicalized groups, one on the right, one on the left. And I just spoke about the one on the right. On the other hand, you have the interesting one on the left, which is emerging now in as the Biden administration begins to make its initial cabinet selections. I will say, overall, these cabinet selections, these have also been a huge bull signal for the market, because by and large, Biden is bringing back all of these, very well-credentialed Ivy League Obama holdovers. They are very liberal, yes, of course, but they're also very pro-stimulus on debt deficits and monetary policy. They're all globalists, and they're all pro-business, right? And this time, unlike during Obama, they're all now shifting to be have sort of been converted into becoming much more pro-stimulus, and likely they won't be facing the same huge Tea Party Republican opposition to deficit spending, right? Because after all, I mean, Trump never saw a deficit he didn't like, and I think he's sort of converted the Republican Party on that. So this is a very interesting development. Sooner or later, yes, Biden will get around to scrapping the Trump tax cut and probably push taxes even higher. but not at the moment. You remember he's said his first agenda, his first item is fighting COVID, right? And so this is all like green lights to the market. So this is just one big push to the global carry trade, right? It's just going to, everyone's push volatility down, push leveraging up. This is great news. So, you know, go out and buy all your garbage stocks, maybe. You know, we'll see. We'll be reporting on this. This is definitely what they call a risk on moment. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, not Susan Rice, who would probably not likely be, confirmed by the Senate anyway. The Republicans truly hate her. Antony Blinken, though, Europeanist, multilateralist, globalist, and interventionist, I should add. He's totally French-speaking. He's a child of Holocaust survivors, six-year aide to Biden in the Senate. He's exactly what Biden announced to do in foreign policy. Secretary of Defense has yet to be unchosen. The talk is that is probably going to be Michelle Flournoy. Again, a left opposition developing to her. Why? Because she supported the surge under Obama. And she also is, has relationships with defense contractors, you know, which taints her in the eyes of the left. Treasury Secretary, whoa, the market's got to love this, Janet Yellen, right? I think Lael Brainard might have been acceptable to the markets. I think Elizabeth Warren would have been a downer. But Janet Yellen, I mean, you got to love that, right? The markets loved her. And Wally Adeyemo, who's, you know, formerly worked as a consultant for BlackRock, and she's top deputy. Again, you know, pro-business. None of this, it's not like you're going to get Bernie Sanders in there as Treasury Secretary. And head of OMB, Neera Tanden. She is hated by the left, I must say. Why? Because she was a top Hillary person, a very abrasive personality, and she was head of the CAP, which is the Center for American Progress, the big sort of Clinton-funded outfit. It gets huge amounts of money from the Saudis, from businesses, like the Clintons, they don't really care where they get the money. You know, they get it from everywhere, and I don't know how many people they hire. It has a staff of over 200 people. Anyway, she is the top fundraiser, and she's very vocal. She is, I think the left properly senses that she is definitely not on their side, and she returns the favor. She has been out to get Bernie Sanders many, many a time. And so there you have it. Chief Economist Cecilia Rouse to chair the CEA, the Council of Economic Advisors. A very well-regarded Princeton labor economist, Jaron Greenstein, who's been around forever. He's at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And Heather Boushey, another former economist at the Center for American Progress. Again, that's the Clinton outfit. Now, these are very pro-labor. They're very progressive, but they're very mainstream. I mean, you get the idea. It's always very well-credentialed, well-thought of, sort of in the center of their profession. Attorney General Merrick Garland. Wouldn't that be an interesting comeback? That name has been raised, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Jones. Well, he got defeated in Alabama, but I guess this could be a second life. I didn't know that he was a legal talent. I guess he is. And maybe he'll get confirmed, and maybe he won't. Homeland Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, Obama's Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. Now, Obama, for those of you who don't remember, deported more people than Trump did. I mean, the guy was hard-nosed on deportations, and is true, did not do the big sort of dramatic and flamboyant stuff that Trump has done. And, you know, they didn't work on a wall or anything like that. But they're definitely hardline on enforcing borders. Biden has made it clear many times that he is not for open borders, right? And So there you have it again. This is, again, I think, reassuring to the markets. I don't know, though. It does point to an emerging split, I think, that could be really interesting to watch in the Democratic Party between basically the technocratic elite, right, which just wants to run the system, just tweak a few dials, right? That's the only thing it needs, as opposed to the left, which say you got to break some eggs, you got to start knocking stuff down. You know, the systemic problems with our system right now need stronger medicine than that. So you see a split growing in the Democrats as well as a split growing in the Republicans. I can't wait to see how this pans out. Let me just move on. The only thing I want to mention of foreign policy interest, this has to do with the big news this week, the killing, I should say, the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Farizadeh. It turns out that he was killed remotely. Apparently, a Nissan armed with a remote-controlled machine gun, went up and did something to his car. I guess he got out. Some of the bodyguards got out, and then, they were all shot dead, and then the Nissan blew itself up. How's that for eliminating evidence? Much of the commentary has focused on how Trump was somehow trying to undermine the efforts of Biden to reinstate the anti-nuke deal, the, so-called JCPA with Iran. And I think, yeah, that was probably what he was trying to do. And probably Israel, who probably carried it out, would also like to undermine it. But I think one thing to look at is a piece written, an excellent op-ed piece, actually, I thought, in the New York Times by Tom Friedman, on how Biden may not be fully aware of how much the Mideast has changed since Obama signed the deal. And one point he makes very well, and I recommend people actually to look at it who are interested in foreign policy, is Friedman points out, I think rightly, the one event that every power in the Mideast believes has changed the correlation of forces there. And that's something we hardly remember right now. We don't remember very well. And that's the Iranian drone and cruise missile attack on the Saudi refinery back in August of 2019. That was just a little over a year ago. Because what happened there was that Iran showed that it had the ability to deliver a deadly attack through extraordinarily targeted weaponry. I mean, these drones and cruise missiles just flew, I don't know, 20, 30 feet over the surface of the earth. They were indetectable by radar, and they all hit their targets. And this is scaring everyone because it's no longer, like Iran of old and Iraq of old, just sending up a lot of missiles and just hoping they land in the right places. Hezbollah will soon be armed with the same technology. And basically what it's done is it's stepping up Israel's efforts to thwart every effort by Iran to develop its offensive capability. And it's also driving all of the big Arab powers into a security alliance with Israel. So Friedman's message is that it's likely that much of the Middle East will be opposed to reopening and restarting the JCPA. And this is a game changer, especially given the bloody victory of Iran's ally Bashar al-Assad against his Sunni Arab enemies. And so Iran still has that huge belt, going all the way to the Mediterranean that they can work through. Very interesting piece and some new realities that Biden might be facing as he gets fully briefed and figures out what he wants to do in the wider world. I think we've already gone well over our time. We already have a conversation coming up, so this is going to be, I guess, a pretty long podcast and all. But as always, thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you again next week.
Good afternoon, and thanks, everyone, for joining us. My name is Andrew Friedman, Communications Sector Head here at Hedgeye, and I'm excited to be joined by Neil Howe, Head of Demography. Before we get into this conversation about internet dating, interactive media, as well as social media, please listen to the following disclaimer.
Hedgeye is a Connecticut registered investment advisor. Hedgeye is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice to individuals. This research is not an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. It is made without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice, nor does it contain any legal or tax opinions. Source information is believed to be reliable, but Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, omissions, or the authenticity of source information. The opinions and conclusions are those of the individual speaking. This report is protected by U.S. and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipients. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. There is a fee associated with access to the support and accompanying materials. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. By joining this call or possessing these materials, you agree to these terms. Contact sales at hedgeye.com regarding access questions.
All right, great. And if you have any questions, please submit them to qa@hedgeye.com, or you can send them directly to me at afriedman@hedgeye.com, and we'll be sure to answer them either as we go here or towards the end. So, that being said, Neil, it's great to have you on the line. Wish we could have you live on video, but understand that's not possible, so we're going to make do today. Lots of wood to chop in the space, big topics. We could probably sit here and do an hour conversation on each. We're not going to do that, obviously, today. Probably waste too many people's time doing so. Again, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks, Andrew, as always. There's always so much going on in your space that sort of overlaps with things that interest me. Sort of cutting edge social and generational and demographic trends.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I will say this, you start out with one of my favorites, which is online dating. And we've taken an interest in that for a long time. I've been bullish on this for several years. I've done several reports on it. Did one, I think about 2 years ago, a big one. We gave all these, kind of went through all the drivers behind it. And my gosh, look at what, the Match Group has done this year, on top of what it was already doing over the previous 2 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, the performance has been, pretty phenomenal. It's amazing to just see the adoption curve, right, and just online dating getting, pretty much acceptance across the board. We do have a slide deck just for folks. I just want to mention that. We're not going to go through each slide, but there's some good data that we'll probably reference as we go here. But, Neil, one of the things I wanted to just touch on was that latest report from Pew Research, and I was curious if you had any, takeaways from that. One of the things that stood out to me, at least, was that it looks like we're at pretty high adoption in terms of people that have intent. So those that are single and looking are about 80% of that population indicates that they have used a dating app before. I'm curious how you think about kind of the space, but also any takeaways from that survey specifically.
Well, the most interesting thing I found on that survey is, it was mainly about the difficulties people have finding a partner. And I frequently talked about the more general problem of loneliness in America. This mm-hmm. is particularly a huge an issue for millennials. The biggest discussion, if you look at, Twitter and the internet, the biggest concern about loneliness is millennials, and it's one reason why they're moving in with other people, right? Either with other millennials or their parents. And they're most concerned about finding community. It's an issue with all generations today, and obviously millennials are moving into urban environments, which tend to be anonymous and uprooting, from traditional social networks. But the loneliness issue is here, and many of these apps aren't just for romantic relationships. Many of them are just for any kind of, friendships or professional relationships, or just more broadly to find other people in their lives, sometimes just mentors and so on.
Yeah.
The single biggest thing I found was the was that, you know, women find it much more difficult than men to find a partner that meets their expectations by something like, you know, nearly 60% to 35%. And that actually, you know, we did a piece on that, I think about 3 years ago, called Millennial Women Just Can't Find Enough Men. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, men are falling behind women in terms of education, salary, and professional attainment. And this is sort of an age-old phenomenon. You know, women like to marry up in terms of achievement. And they're no longer finding that. There's a huge dissatisfaction among millennial women. Now, one thing you'll find in all of these surveys, and I've looked at them all, women never like to say they're looking, you know. So men are always more likely to say they're looking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is traditional. You know, women always like to think, you know, I don't have to look. You know, people are going to come after me. That's more of the acceptable thing to say, right? So you always have to keep that in mind. I'll say the one single thing, though, that I flagged, and that's actually a commentary on political polarization in America today, is dating across political party is now a far greater taboo than dating someone of a different race, ethnicity, or religion. So, you know, what dating blacks is far more okay with most people than someone who voted for Hillary dating someone who voted for Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Match Group, and, I don't think has a. I don't think they've rolled out apps across the board. I know they have Chispa and BLK to go out to Latin American and African American communities, but they haven't launched a Republican or a Democrat dating app yet.
Well, they do. I think there's one called, you know, Rightward or something for Trump voters. So, you know, that I guess that's how the deplorables can find each other or something like that. Anyway, there you have it. It's an interesting industry. There are a number of players. The big one is Match Group, you know, with Tinder, Match, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish, Hinge, all these things. Mm-hmm. There is another group that is public. It's run out of Berlin. It's called Spark Networks, and they have things like Zoosh and Mingle. They have a lot of upscale things like elite singles and so on, and we're going to come back to that in a second because I think there's a real possibility there. There's a Russian company called Badu, which is very popular in Mediterranean countries.
Yeah.
No one really knows how they're doing that. They don't have a great reputation.
I don't think they're doing that well, Neil. Frankly, that's at least exactly. Mark checks. But
Bumble, as you know, is someone who left Tinder, and it's sort of a, you know, she likes to call it a feminist dating app. And then finally, you have eHarmony, which is a kind of its own company. It's again now owned by a German, you know, holding company, and it has its own approach, which is kind of pricey and very processy, and you don't really have as many choices. And they haven't been, they were an early player. They haven't been spectacularly successful. Yeah. A Match Group is, you know, revenue now of something like, you know, $2 billion, half a billion in net income. So that's a great profit margin.
No, I mean, they've been Match has been phenomenal in terms of managing their portfolio of apps and then more recently just really starting to monetize. And I know that's something that we've talked about and you've provided some interesting color on is the monetization potential, right? And kind of, you know, this concept of like whales on these apps and their ability to tier out. So I'd love to kind of get your take on, you know, what you think the opportunity is.
Well, here is how I would go through the drivers, the positive drivers. And then we could talk a few things about, you know, some of the possible negatives or threats on the immediate horizon. But here are some of the big sort of social demographic drivers, generational drivers.
Yep.
The first is the total addressable market. We started by talking about that. It's huge. You know, I don't know, the number of single adults, unmarried, unattached adults is close to 100 million. I mean, it's enormous. Most of these people have not yet used regularly a dating app. You know, it's been calculated that Tinder, if they were just to get one quarter of single people under age 30 to use their app. That would be like an eightfold increase. I think it's now something like 1 million. So in other words, big total addressable market that is still far from being, you know, mined yet. The second is this total addressable market is growing faster than population. And that's because people are marrying later, right, staying mm-hmm. single longer. And you have a lot of, you know, boomers, first wave Xers, you know, hate to mention this, but, you know, they're they're breaking up. Some of them are getting divorces and so on. So it's both in the both on the young end and the long end. And by the way, those are kind of two different markets. You have your, you know, you have your people who are sort of, you know, a little bit older, who are, you know, maybe after a marriage, but you have this enormous market before a permanent relationship. So the third big driver is generational. There's a lot about online dating which hugely appeals to millennials. Let's face it, it requires very little effort. There's less risk. You don't have to go into some dark, dangerous bar.
Yeah.
And you know, particularly since the pandemic, I mean, you don't have to risk your life meeting someone. And it's no accident, of course, that Match is obviously among those companies that's hugely surged, you know, surged during the COVID time. And it's also oriented around menu-driven optimization, which is a big winner for millennials, right? Millennials like to know what the parameters are. They like to be able to be given sort of these left-brain, menu-driven, you know, means of optimizing on this or that. You know what I mean? I mean, they love to know the parameters and how I get at my corner solution that works, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's where the algorithm, and I mean, it's interesting, right? Because part of when I did research in this space, I created an online account for every single one. So I guess I violated the terms and services a little bit, but
wow,
I canceled the account pretty quick. But the questions that they ask you, it is very uniform. To your point on adoption by generation and there being kind of an app for everything, we have a slide in the deck that kind of shows the, across the Match properties, at least what the adoption looks like. And for, you know, something like a Hinge, obviously it over indexes, on the US dating app user mix by age. Eric is the slide.
Right.
But you can see it over indexes to like the 18 to 34, the millennial cohort. So,
Well, Hinge, and that's actually something very interesting too, because Hinge is more oriented to people who want more permanent relationships. And, you know, that actually gets to some of the frustrations, you know, with Tinder, right? Like too many options. I mean, one of the realities of life that a lot of millennials have to confront is that if you're constantly given a choice of, you know, switching out on the next person who's just perfect, you'll never find anyone, because all of those, you know, take it from me, and all of these people who are older will tell you that a good relationship ultimately is, you know, is being with someone and trying to make things work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hate to say, at some point, relationships do require work. Yes, that is true. A fourth big trend, and this is social trends, is the movement of toward urban life, right? We've seen that particularly among people with money, and we see that among millennials, right? So urban life involves uprooting. You don't have a lot of traditional institutions bringing people together. That's a huge tailwind, again, for e-dating. I find this fascinating now. The norm of e-dating actually encourages e-dating, meaning, and I've talked to a lot of guys, and this is true, that you no longer feel like you actually want to introduce yourself to someone in person, because you kind of assume that if they wanted to date, they would be doing it online. Right? It's funny now, you know, and you're not supposed to do it at work, you know, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've become very particular now about an inappropriate advance, right, in the wrong social situation. So you can see how the very norm itself becomes self-fulfilling. You see how that works? I mean, you know, if you want to date, you know, do it online. Don't bother me here.
Well, the rules of, I guess the rules of engagement are, you know, are set, right? You, everyone's on the same platform. You know what to expect. And so that kind of makes it a little bit easier.
But it also means that it's just harder. It's a little bit more awkward now to do something in person. I mean, maybe before
Well, actually,
your time,
Neil,
Andrew,
on that point, if you don't mind, like on that point, do you think that it perversely kind of feeds into this epidemic of loneliness that you referenced at the beginning? Because I mean, I'm assuming that trend isn't something that's always persisted forever. I mean, I think everyone's always, you know, sought companionship and, you know, valued relationships. But do you think that this digital adoption and what you just referenced is actually, you know, making it worse in some ways?
Well, but isn't that great to be in an industry that both causes the problem and solves the problem
Well,
it's
that's the thing.
causing?
Well,
I
the
mean,
funny thing with Match is,
that's
like, if they solve their problem, they don't have a business model anymore. But I guess that's the, you know, that's the beauty of
Well,
it.
no, but that's the beauty of it,
Yeah.
right? It creates the problem at the same time you're solving it. So, but I do think, I mean, you're right. I mean, we know, for instance, one of the reasons why, you know, the introduction of AI at McDonald's and so on works because millennials actually prefer not to talk to anybody. You know, let me just, you know, do it through an app and you know, give me what I want, and that way I don't have to bother with talking to real people. But again, it's a little bit of this optimization psychology, which can often just rule out dealing with unpredictable real people, because that's just one less thing that's you know, an unpredictable moving part in my life. I think the dissatisfaction that Pew talks about with relationships is another social tailwind. So people are driven to move toward new solutions. Now, one big thing that I think has not been entirely exploited is upselling. We talked a little bit about that, Andrew, but the one other thing about e-dating, which I really like, is it's extremely important to people. It's solving a very important problem in people's lives. I mean, if you're selling Spotify, okay, you know, streaming music is great, right? But I mean, you know, how important really is it? I mean, you know, and what are the substitutes, and how much am I willing to pay for it? But finding the right person in my life, are you joking? I mean, that's like, I mean, you know, you're going to merge it, presumably your net worth with someone, completely join your lives to another person. I mean, can you put a price tag on that? So this creates the possibility of upselling, creating more exclusive services for people who can pay for a better service. And it's just worth saying that there are personal matchmaking services in every city who introduce you personally to people, which, you know, cost a lot of money, cost, you know, $1,000, $2,000, thousands of dollars, depending on how much you want to spend. So this is the idea that these companies could move into. Now, interestingly, Spark Networks has actually started to do that a little bit more explicitly than Match.com, and I think it's only a matter of time before Match does
Yeah.
it.
Well, yeah, Match has been implementing on the market, like, I mean, slowly. They haven't gone at it the super aggressively, but concierge functionality to kind of
Exactly,
to go
and
after
I
that.
think that's a big opportunity, right? That's
Yeah.
just, you get that part of the demand curve, which is way up there. You just invent a new segment. And then finally, there are no real direct competitors, and multiple use is common. You know, and you could be even argued, now, one of the great threats, and people have been talking about this for a couple of years now since Zuckerberg announced this, that is Facebook as a competitor. Facebook now has a, you know, it doesn't cost anything, but you can join the service and
Yeah.
it will look for, you know, contacts and so on. But it may actually not even be that bad for Match, because it just will get certain people used to the idea of using a service at all,
Yeah.
and then they can also use another service.
Well, the other thing I've always thought about competition from Facebook is that, you know, they're already running into antitrust issues. Privacy is going to be a problem, right? So, you know, dating apps, they're, you know, they serve their purpose, but I think the amount of investment in terms of monitoring and making sure that the experience is appropriate, I guess probably the best way to say it, you know, is a lot. And then also advertising. I mean, one of the things I've heard consistently too is that advertising really turns off engagement with dating apps and hurts monetization, which is, you know, something that I guess Facebook's going to have to overcome at some point.
I agree. I agree. One big issue that they do have a stake in is this new series of suits against Apple for, you know, the cost of downloading the app, you know, from the Apple Store. And this is actually a positive, because if there's any resolution that you know, works for Fortnite and for Spotify and all the interested people here, will also be good for them. Mm-hmm. One possible negative, which has come to light recently, A&E recently did a series about, you know, serial, you know, perpetrators of sexual violence against women, you know, hanging out on.
I mean, that stuff's awful. I mean, but I mean, you have like Craigslist killers. I mean, you have bad things that happen with Ubers. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, you're told not to get in a car with strangers, and then, or, you know, and then we're in a world where, you know, you use your phone to summon a stranger to come pick you up, and you get in their car. So there's a lot of faith you're putting in these platforms in order to monitor that type of security. But that's, you know, I think that's generally a broader issue for the internet. Neil, we did have two questions on online dating that I want to ask you, and then I think maybe we can switch topics here, because you start to talk about AR, VR, and I think it is related to online dating, frankly, in terms of engagement and the experience. But internationally, in countries like India and Japan, where are we? What are the major hangups there? And do you think that over the next 5 to 10 years, you know, there's going to be enough social change and cultural acceptance to really drive adoption of online dating? That's question number one. Question number two is on socioeconomic status. And whether it's income levels, adoption, anything that you're seeing there that, you know, folks should be particularly aware of impacting the space?
Well, just due to the second question first, I think that my main point about socioeconomic status and adoption is that there's a huge untapped opportunity at the high end, meaning that someone who has money, wants something intelligent, and wants to sort of, you know, sort of segment their market accordingly, there's no really great place for that person to go necessarily. And no one really offering something that's not, you know, that's digital, or that's some combination of digital and personal or something. Anyway, I just think there's an enormous opportunity there. You know, in other countries, you've got huge cultural issues, and, you know, a lot of societies, India is a good case, where a lot of marriages are still, I mean, arranged or quasi-arranged. You know, parents usually at least have a big say in choosing people, even among, you know, I mean, one issue obviously with India, the middle class that you can really monetize is obviously a lot smaller than the population of India. But even that population is still surprisingly traditional. And so you've got some kind of acceptance issues there. I know they've had some real problems during the pandemic. They've seen some real attrition. That's probably one of their, as they talked about that in their recent earnings reports.
One of the things about India that I always found interesting is that it's not a big market for a lot of companies. It's largely ad-based, and it's not a wealthy country across many standards. But, you know, to your point on the affluent and there being this, like, very small percentage of people that are willing to spend a lot of money, you know, in that respect, then it's a potentially larger market for a company like a Match. I think if you could break open, you know, or, you know, get rid of, like, you know, just make it more acceptable, right? I don't know. That's always kind of how I thought about it. I could be wrong. But it seems like...
Yeah, but then as you get, you know, again, you're dealing with a very traditional culture, and, you know, even Match would be unaffordable, you know, at anything close to its current price. You're right. If you had a totally ad-supported version, maybe. But then again, there's very little money to be made in ads in India for the same reason. And
do you think it changes, Neil? I mean, do you think that, I mean, ultimately the seas of change, like, I know we have all these cultural issues now, but, I mean, do you think that, you know, it's moving? Do you think that these are like structural barriers that are going to persist?
Well, that change, that those kinds of things change on a very long calendar, Andrew.
Yeah,
those things don't change overnight. So anyway, I think there might be something very tailored, but it would be something very culturally appropriate. It would probably involve a lot of experimentation. I think East Asia, sort of your Confucian societies, are a little bit more ready for it. And I think these are more popular there. You know, one issue there, of course, is there's, and maybe that's a good thing, is that there's a lot of interest in, you know, dating and relationships, declining interest in ever getting married. Of course, that's a problem for all of East Asia right now.
It's not good for your growth, economic growth, that people are.
Well, that's kind of a long-term demographic issue, isn't it?
So. Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, thank you. I think we're going to, let's segue here into interactive media. And I know this is a topic it's new. I mean, we had Roblox file their S-1. This concept of the metaverse has been talked about for a very long time. In the same vein of augmented reality and virtual reality, so much of the adoption that we see is really amongst, like, you know, 13 and under. And we have some slides in the deck that kind of show that. But nonetheless, the adoption has been very rapid. And I think the question becomes, Neil, what is the applicability of these kind of metaverses beyond just this young cohort where it is just gaming? You know, can this actually permeate life of adults? Can it become more integrated into our society, and therefore the growth opportunity is much larger than what it is today? Big picture question, but you're the big picture guy, which is why we're here, so I'll let you go.
Well, I mean, you know, I figure that in terms of the three things you're talking about, metaverse and VR and AR, I would just say that, you know, near term, you know, my biggest enthusiasm is for AR. I think augmented reality is just amazing. It's going to be applied to everything now. We are now seeing designs for, you know, heads-up displays on car windows, right? So you'll see all the navigation there on your, you know, windshield. Everything about, you know, traffic times and stoplights and, you know, everything you can imagine, right? I mean, that would be so cool. Even, you know, points of interest if you're looking around. Eventually, when we get something like Google Glass, which I think we'll have to invent again or bring it back, you're going to see its enormous utility and in airports and malls, giving people directions, virtual meetings so that you can navigate them very easily, almost as though you were there at a conference. Those of us who've been Zooming, we realize how clunky and old school a lot of that technology is for Zoom conferences. Well, imagine something that looks like some facsimile of being at an actual conference and actually identifying people that you're meeting and milling around. In the professions, everything from an electrician, a plumber, a doctor, imagine a device that would automatically identify, just simply recognize and identify. You open the hood of your car and something would just instantly identify what every part is, right? How you can replace it, its function. Or imagine an electrician, you know, doing the same thing. These are augmentation devices so that you just make people more productive, which is, I think, incredibly valuable, right? You're not replacing people. You're just making one individual be able to do much more. I didn't even mention, imagine tourism, you know, being able to walk around a new environment to instantly identify all of the churches or scenic places all around you and give you any information. Now, one area where it's already being used with some success, I think we're going to see it continuing, is in commerce. Go into a store, and this will device will you know, whatever you look at on the shelves, it'll tell you its ingredients, how much it is, how you can get a discount. You can, rather than, you know, be able to you know, scan a code or, you know, all of that stuff. It would just recognize it and tell you, imagine Best Buy using that, right? You go into Best Buy, and instead of looking at all this stuff, you're not sure exactly what it is, you can find out everything you want about it by just kind of having this AR kind of do a labeling and text or audio overlap, right, on whatever it is you're looking at. I just think there's incredible possibility for that that are really doable. I mean, sort of immediate horizon kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, thinking that through, it's at least on the retail side, it's the implications for employment are in the in retail are probably, you know, you just like with any technological shift, right? You increase productivity, but you're at the same time, you know, taking costs out of the system. So, you know, it's probably bad for structural employment ultimately in retail. And, you know, in terms of AR, I mean, it's funny. Like, AR hit the scene with Pokemon Go a couple of years ago. And we're continuing to see interesting innovation. Pinterest is doing some really interesting things with, like, makeup companies for in terms of determining, you know, what your skin tone is and incorporating that with brands. And I think, you know, beyond it, and I know we talked about this before, but, like, the applications in brand advertising and the marketing side, I think, is really interesting too, above and beyond just the, I guess the utility function, right, that you so well described before.
Yeah, so that's what I think about AR. I think VR is been a little bit of a disappointment. You've got Oculus, which is, you know, the big kind of alternative thing that Zuckerberg has been so big on since they bought it. I think we're now on to the Quest 2 now, which is their device. Sony is the other big player. I think this is a device which goes through the PlayStation. And here, I think that the two big problems with virtual reality. One problem is just the lack of good software made for it yet. And, you know, we finally have a new effort, a new game, a new Star Wars game made by Entertainment Arts. In other words, get one of these big software companies that really knows how to do this stuff well, right? And really design a game for virtual reality, for virtual reality. And they've done it. They have a new Star Wars game, which is apparently pretty cool. So I think that's one thing, just the slowness to adapt, to develop software for the virtual reality. And I think the other problem is sort of inherent in the electronics itself. And this may be actually just a problem with the speed of light. And this is called, you know, the latency problem, or, you know, kind of from motion to photon, as they often say, right? I mean, how long does it take for you to, one problem with virtual reality is that, you know, you turn your head suddenly, like everything instantly has to change, or else you get, you know, the familiar kind of, you know, motion sickness and so forth. And the latency has to be very small. It has to be down in the range of 10 or 20 milliseconds. And this is a problem even with even local systems that use very advanced, you know, hardware and software. They have to be synced just right. You have to have a system that makes sure that it's buffered correctly and that you can, you know, you come on.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing 60 screens a second, it's going to come on at just the right time. But it creates very difficult problems. If you want a multiplayer game, you know, with people all around the world, there you actually have a problem with just speed of light considerations. You know, no matter how efficient you are, you're just going to have, you know, too much latency. And this actually explains the fact that there are actually these in-person studios that are developing of virtual reality arcades. With fairly stiff prices, up to $50 an hour, And the biggest chain of them is a very interesting name, zero latency, right? I mean, that gives you the idea of the problem.
Yeah.
And there are a whole bunch of them now in cities, and you can go to these things. And, of course, then you're using the best hardware, the best software. You get your friends together, and you're all local, right? So isn't that cool? So you can all sort of interact together. And then you can have the truly social experience. You remember why Zuckerberg wanted this. He wanted this is to be sort of the total encompassing emotional experience with to bring vast communities together. And I think the latency really is still a problematic barrier to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think social media, it seems pretty clear that, I mean, and Zuckerberg's been on record saying this too, right, that the future is going to be VR for these platforms, and we're, you know, 20, 30 years from now, we're going to look back at Facebook of what it is today, and we're going to think it's fairly archaic by, you know, the level of engagement that we'll have going forward. I think it's interesting, though, like, it obviously makes a ton of sense that the role that this plays in our society today is just going to be more supplemental, or, you know, making the current experience, elevating current experiences, making us more productive, which is the augmented reality role. I fully agree with you on the technological hurdles for virtual reality. It's very expensive. I've used Oculus. I've used the PlayStation virtual system to play games. You get nauseous. It doesn't work. It's still very early days. And I guess maybe if we can fast forward, and you talked about all the potential applications of AR that seem more real to us today, but what if we could just solve the latency issue for VR? What if we could just solve those technology problems? And then how do you think about where virtual reality could play a role in society above and beyond gaming? And maybe maybe the answer is no. Maybe it is just a gaming feature. But I'm just curious, like, how you could envision it.
Yeah, I mean, let's assume that we, surpass speed of light. And, okay, we get around.
Well, I mean, look, I think there's going to be some. I mean, I'm not – these barriers are – they seem impossible. But, you know, we're going to get there. There's going to be – and there's clearly investment, right? So I'm just curious, like, if you think – yeah.
Ultimately, it's going to be a little bit of is this going to be dystopian, or is this actually going to be society that you and I will want to live in? I do wonder about that. I mean, you let's come back. It is actually a great way to move to the Ernest Cline novel, right?
Yeah.
Ready Player One, which is now Ready Player Two, and it's a big search hunt now on a Roblox menu, right?
Yep.
To where all these people are out there, doing the search. But, I mean, think about it. So you've got America in the 2040s, post some terrible crisis. This is kind of, post-apocalyptic, and we're all in a shambles, all living in shanty towns. And the one great thing that happens is some kid, you know, goes into an artificial world and finds, and successfully overcomes this great treasure hunt of some extra devised on stuff that it was really important to him back in the 1980s. And that's supposed to, redeem our world, right? I don't know. You think about how healthy a prospect that is.
I mean, I don't think it's. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be looking forward to that, right? But I mean, in terms of its application,
I'm getting something a little bit more fundamental. I mean, it's just that the whole premise of that world is that you go into an alternative world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this gets at actually one of the dangers of all the things we've been talking about online dating and everything. If you're always looking for the next possible person, if you're always looking for a virtual world, when do you actually stop role-playing and actually start playing actual life? I mean, think about it. At some point...
I just think of the Matrix. I don't know. I'm just thinking about getting plugged into the Matrix.
But you have to be a parent, and you have to raise a real child rather than a Tamagotchi. I mean, you understand what I mean? I mean, at some point... There is a real world out there. It's challenging, and it has its tragedies.
Yeah.
You overcome them, and you become a real person. And I think that this is where I think Zuckerberg's dream is attractive, but also somewhat disturbing. And I think that a lot of us react to it with a mixture of emotions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's also ultimately, and we talked a little bit about this when we spoke yesterday too, with, you know, the challenge for like a Roblox is the engagement is amazing. You have this young cohort of spending a ton of money on this platform. But then the fact that it can scale so fast probably also means that another company can come in and scale equally as fast. And then the question always just becomes, you know, is what are the applications for this above and beyond just this demographic? You know, is it just, and I think just from this conversation, what I'm taking away is that the answer is it's probably not, there probably isn't any, at least any time in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, it seems like that the applications are not
well,
there.
I see one of the problems is you see a lot of people using that, in fact, a somewhat increasing share, I think, over the past couple of years using Roblox is very young. I mean, they're under 13. They're playing Adopt Me, probably, or something like that, right? But there are a lot of games like that available for kids. I mean, my kids, I see them constantly playing with stuff like that. I mean, and there's a lot of them out there, even brands now have these games out there. I think we were talking about this the other day. Retail clothing brands now have little games. You can, you know, wear their clothing and their brand stuff with their friends and do little races and run around and so on. So there are a lot of these little things that people play. I think a lot of millennials when they were younger went on these Flash platforms, you know, and played these little games. By the way, I think Flash is officially ending at the end of this year. I'm not sure, but you will no longer be able to enter that, I think, on regular computers anymore. But my point is that everyone then went on to other stuff, right? These are kind of arcade-like games, and their look and feel. I'm just wondering how much continuity there is. I mean, looking forward, I love the idea of Roblox in the sense that people can create their own worlds. I would prefer that it be more a little bit like Minecraft, where the kids are actually doing more of the creation themselves, right? I think that's a little bit more interesting, right? But I don't know. I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah,
about
I mean,
it,
look, I think it's kind of really interesting to the extent that what the platform does is it incentivizes developers to come on and gives them opportunity to monetize, and there's a revenue share in place to kind of create these own worlds. And so you can host live concerts with artists, especially, you know, given the world we live in today. Now that's obviously going to change as things open back up. but it is an interesting platform, especially to reach a much younger audience. Look, as a financial analyst, I'm just looking at the numbers in terms of bookings and monetization and engagement, and they're just off the charts in so many ways. But you know, if you're a brand, I mean, the advertising opportunities are also, you know, pretty interesting as well. You know, most of the money Roblox makes is all through, you know, virtual currencies. It's coming through these app stores. There's engagement-based payouts with the content creators. I'm just looking at the average bookings per daily active user in the second and third quarter, and it was, you know, 1481 in the second quarter, 1373 in the third quarter. So it's an interest.
Is branding possible, or would that ruin it?
If you're a developer and you create a world, then they're giving you a platform where you can monetize that world if you can attract users to it. So it's like, it's the same, I guess it's the similar concept to, you know, if I build a theme park, you know, am I building a Disney World, or if I'm building a Six Flags, but it's virtual and I have all these users, and then I have to figure out a way to attract them. And I'm incentivized because I can monetize that. There's a payout. But I did speak with an agency who actually did one of their brands did sponsor a live concert event inside, I believe, Fortnite. And they said that they saw a lot of good numbers coming out of that. So I think there is a place for it.
Ready Player Two is a good example. I mean, movie coming up. This is promo, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the perfect example. Now, I think the biggest issue is going just to be ultimately, because I'm sure this company is going to go public at an insane valuation, which probably somewhat deserved. But it's, and this is going to be to be determined, can they evolve? And does this have application outside of just gaming? One of the things that, I've always kind of thought where it could have application potentially, especially in kind of this post-COVID world that we live in, is around virtual conferences, right? And can you increase engagement? Can you have people create avatars? And a lot of it just comes down to just cultural adoption, right? So, Asia and China's, much further along in acceptance, right? Just in use of how they use media to communicate. I think 5-10 years ago in the U.S., no one was using memes or it just wasn't seen as widely acceptable, and now it's becoming much more, acceptable course of conversation, even in the business community. And I think today it's weird to think that, okay, I'm going to create an avatar of myself and then go to a virtual conference where there's going to be other people from other companies where I'm going to kind of, speak with them. And that type of adoption, I think we're still, further away. But if you had to say hey, find a use case for this, right? I think holding a virtual industry conference or something like that to increase engagement is something that's, potentially interesting because maybe not an investor conference, but maybe something more like a trade show where there's booths, there's different companies, there's side, there's other events that are going on. And I can see being the way to do it, but I'm not sure.
I agree, and I think that is going to happen. I think that also just its use in politics. Why don't we have legislatures, run like this? You can make them maybe a little bit more accessible, transparent. And anything that involves huge numbers of people getting together, I can see that happening. I guess my question is this the platform to do that, right?
That is this a good point.
Is this how it's going to happen?
Yeah,
that's a million dollar question,
right? I mean, is it MySpace or Facebook? I mean, it's still very early days, and you can just look at the numbers and the history of Roblox. I mean, they just really only became what they became in the last, 12 to 18 months. And so it's going to be interesting to see, how it evolves or if there's other platforms. I mean, they provide the platform for developers to come on.
It would be nice if they had just an example of something a little bit more adult-like.
Yeah, tangible.
You know what I mean? And non-gaming, where you could actually see its functionality. But that would be, I agree. That would be very powerful. I totally agree. I have no question. I believe entirely that in the future, we will all have more gamified interfaces, with our work, with our education. I mean, look at Warfare now. I mean, it's actually performed, through gamified interfaces that used to be used just for training, right? And even that used to be very novel, right? So, this is how factory work is going to be done. This is how increasingly, medicine will be done. We'll be looking at imagery and so on with the help of AI and gamified interfaces. So we're all going to be living like this.
I think, I think the implications to online dating, too, are interesting as well, right? I mean, for Match, they're early days. They just started getting into live stream, one-to-many. They did something called Swipe Night, which is kind of a augmented reality Bayesian conditional interactive experience where you select certain options and it helps you match with folks. But I mean, I don't know. Could they leverage this platform and create kind of a bar scenario where people can just go mingle in a common area and have that be a way of engaging? I mean, that's something that could potentially work. I mean, and also be another use case, and I think would be interesting.
Well, a lot of people, on the other hand, like online dating because it avoids the social competitiveness of a social environment where you're meeting others, right?
Yeah,
which
that's
is one
a very
of the reasons point. Why people often don't like bar scenes. You know, ultimately, too, the problem is, again, that a successful relationship involves, something tangible, personal, involves some commitment. Interestingly, one secret to sites that work better than have higher success rates are sites where you actually pay a little more, you invest more time in it, and therefore you feel more committed to it, right? The very ease of doing it is actually a predictor of its failure because it's so easy to opt out. That's one of the problems with Tinder. Very very good at getting people interested, not terribly good at getting anyone who really has any commitment at all to what the hell they're doing on that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's I guess to take that. I mean, that's the kind of the power almost of the platform in that. With Match, they can use Tinder as a funnel, and then they have other apps that kind of off-ramp people to that may have equally or higher engagement. So, if I'm in the market for looking for somebody, I'm probably, because I know Tinder's the brand, it's probably what I'm going to look at first. It may not be for me, and then maybe I use Hinge. I think we spent a
good
time.
The real out-of-the-box idea here for millennials is actually a return of the more arranged marriage idea, which is if you ever see like A&E's, Marriage at First Sight, one of these shows where they
talk about going full circle. I mean, that's
well, yeah. I mean, but it's actually returned to something. It's very interesting because once millennials figure that experts or people that they trust have actually chosen someone for them. It's amazing. Suddenly, then I really have to commit myself to this. And it's amazing. Now, sometimes, obviously, that's stupid and it doesn't work at all. But sometimes it actually helps achieve a relationship that works, which was the whole wisdom, of course, of the old idea of arranged marriages, right?
It's interesting.
Anyway, arranged marriages were a very interesting institution because typically, certainly in early modern Europe, where it was common, for the middle class and upper class, the young people always had a veto. It wasn't like you were never forced to marry someone you hated, rarely.
Yeah.
I realize in Jane Austen, occasionally that happened. But that rarely vet people, and then the young people were vetoed.
Yeah. So, I don't have that much time left, but I think it's news media is fragmented. You have conservative and liberal platforms, Fox News, CNN. And what's been really interesting to see is that given the rise in censorship and just how these social media companies have acted is something like Parler. And I don't think it's, it looks like the growth isn't that sustainable, at least in the data, but it's definitely something on our radar. Will we see a fragmentation among social media platforms based off of political affiliation, especially for something like a Twitter that's kind of more news oriented, where it basically just becomes an echo chamber for whoever's, has like the loudest voice or just what the prevailing view is. And then on the second point, it's a long question. How does this all evolve and fit within the context of history, right? You've spent so much time analyzing history and just where we are in the cycles of everything. And I'm just curious how you think that kind of evolves.
Well, okay. We actually did a piece recently on that and looked at Parler and some of the, other sites which are going after the red zoners who were fleeing Twitter and Facebook, right, because of, their censorship activities. My estimate is this won't last.
Mm-hmm.
And that the reason is because if, it's no fun, talking about, fake news and drive-by media and all that stuff if everyone on the site agrees with you. I mean, the whole fun is doing it with others who disagree with you, right? I mean,
that, some, I mean, so, it depends. Some call that fun. Some call that getting trolled. but,
well, no, but the yeah. the point is, no, but it actually is an instinct, which actually is worth pondering, and that is, to some extent, they want to engage. In other words, people want to engage, not necessarily they want to just, you know, cause problems and pain. Some of them do. Yeah, absolutely. Some of them are like terrorists. But I think the problem is that what happens is then you get a site like that. And then, of course, this is called tipping. So sociologists have a theory for it. So you get everyone like that. And, of course, there'll be some people who'll be really extreme and violent, right, which will cause some of the moderates to leave. And then, you know, it'll be even more still. And then even more of the people will leave. And then, you know, ultimately you end up with kind of the raving anon stuff on 4chan, you know what I mean? You just end up with that kind of community. So eventually you end up, you know, where the neighborhood tips completely. You know, the way I like to think of it is Andy, is that we would all like to be, we would all like to live like an anarchist. I think we would all think that would be fun to do, but we'd like to do it in a respectable neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and that's the problem, right?
That's a great way to think about it.
Ultimately, it becomes a neighborhood of anarchists, and then it's no fun anymore, and you want to leave,
and
right?
you want to so find another neighborhood to go to, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. See, it's not stable.
You want to go to you want to find the anarchists on Roblox.
Yeah, maybe. Well, at least a muzzled anarchist.
Yeah.
But my point is that there is a real... it's a treasure when we have a public square, which is to some extent has standards. I mean, I hate to say it. This sounds arbitrary and tyrannical, and I realize that. Look, we always want to protect the right of people, the constitutional right to be able to say whatever they want in some venue, right? And so people who want to can come to them, and that's fine. And I, you know, that's in our constitution. I have no problem with that. But there's also a value of having a public square where people feel safe and they feel that, you know, you can talk politely. And we've had over our history, particularly recently when we had the Fairness Doctrine, right, which I think started in 1949. It was finally ended in 1987. But we, you know, this is pre-internet when we had a limited number of media outlets. And, you know, it wasn't such a bad time.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say it, but... we were a country which is able to voice a reasonable diversity of opinions, and we were able to find common ground and pursue a bunch of important national goals over that period. It wasn't so bad, and I would even say that it may even compare favorably to where we are today, where there's no common ground or consensus on anything. And as a result, our political system is stuck in gridlock. We can't even pass a budget. No one can agree on anything. We've ground to a halt as a country in terms of our ability to function politically. So I think that communication and the development of a public square is a regulated social function. I'll just be honest about it. I think it takes regulation to achieve it. And I think that there is actually a way that this can be done politically, and that is that for this may even be a way for Republicans and Democrats to get together, because Democrats also, you know, they're on board with the idea of fairness, you know, with regard to these standards, and I think they would go along with Republicans, you know, like Josh Hawley and others who've been pursuing this. I think the overlap is that the Democrats are probably more excited even than Republicans, but they're both on board with going after the whole antitrust issues involved in social media, which, you know, remember that it was a Justice Department under Trump, which initiated that big suit in October, right, against Google. And we're going to see a lot more of that. So I think that the whole, you know, antitrust together with regulation of the public square, however you want to define it, will both be two wings of an increasingly regulated world for social media. That's kind of my overall take, if you want to know how I think it's going to spin out. As with regard to partisanship on media, I would have to say that There's nothing new about this historically, and people may not be entirely aware of it. But until very recently, probably until, you know, the Great Depression and the New Deal, with the rise of the whole idea of professional journalism, maybe a little bit earlier to some extent in the 1920s, newspapers in America were always partisan. In fact, newspapers were like, you know, the Des Moines Whig or the New Orleans Democrat. Or, I mean, they were damagingly partisan. Okay, so there is nothing new about complete partisanship in delivery of the news. You know, a lot of people think, you know, I guess have some idea that, you know, back in the Victorian days or throughout the 19th century, we were somehow non-partisan objective. That is absolutely not true. And the invective thrown around in the 1850s and then during Abraham Lincoln's war administration was unbelievable, the charges people were hurling at each other. So we've been through this. It is not, you know, it's, you know, we're tough people, Americans. We can handle this stuff. But there is always a place at which, there was always some venue in which people moderated their voices, and they were actually required to, if they wanted to express themselves at all, you know, actually make arguments and you know, pose reasons for things and have people look at their own social life objectively. And for us to survive as a republic, as a liberal republic, dedicated individuals being able to actually look at ideas and assess evidence, that's the only reason we have a democracy, right? We believe people can do that.
Is that
we believe that there is a place where everyone can participate in some sort of common discussion and ultimately make decisions that some people might not like, but at least we've all been hurt in some way.
Okay. All right. Well, Neil, that was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it, as always. Again, we have to probably do this sometime soon. Maybe we can even spend an entire time diving into one of these topics specifically. But thank you again. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Neil, have a great Thanksgiving, great holiday.
Andrew, same to you, and same to you. Stay COVID safe. You know, I'll be.
I'm not doing anything.
I'll be doing another one of my COVID reports, and it right now, at least near term, it doesn't look great, does it?
So
we should all stay safe over the holidays. No question about it.
Okay, Neil. Thank you so much, and again, thank you, everybody, and have a good holiday. Take care.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.